The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Lots to get to on today's program. A brief update here on the London PAC campaign. That's for late October, coming up in just a few weeks. Well, a few weeks after the Feast of Tabernacles. Right now, we have 83 people registered for the Sunday night Bible lecture, which is October 21st. And of those 83, 56 are not members of the Philadelphia Church of God. And then the second night, we have 54 total registered so far, and 39 of them non-members. And we're pre-packaging the second wave of invitations to go out, I believe, in early October. So hopefully we'll get another wave of people registering. But as I said to you last week, we've had quite a lot of excited people anxious to hear those lectures down in London. Well, on today's program, we're going to talk some about the hurricane to sweep through the Carolinas. It's been downgraded to a tropical storm now, but quite a lot of flooding associated with this storm. And also, on the other side of the world, you have Typhoon Mangkhut, I guess is how the pronunciation goes there, but it worked its way through the Philippines last week, and then hit southern China yesterday, and dozens of people have been killed in that storm as well. Later on, we'll be talking about some of the droughts and the fires in the western part of the United States. And speaking of the so-called natural disasters, we'll follow up from Friday's program on the death toll in that storm a year ago that hit Puerto Rico. And what the president tweeted last week, and then look at what FEMA director Brock Long had to say on one of the news shows yesterday. Well, I want to begin the first segment here with what my father said in Saving America from the Radical Left, or just to paraphrase, he said that this whole Trump-Russia investigation is based on a hoax, a hoax. Here, this special investigation, this probe, Robert Mueller, they've been searching for evidence of collusion for well over a year now, nearly a year and a half, and nothing. They found nothing. And before that, the investigation led by the FBI, Peter Strzok, Lisa Page, Comey, McCabe, all of them, I mean, they were investigating it before Bob Mueller came along. Nothing. They found nothing. Together with that, all of these other reports, full-length books. In the case of Bob Woodward's piece or book from, what was that, last week that it came out? Or maybe the week before. Listen to what Bob Woodward had to say on Hugh Hewitt's radio program. This is clip one.
Did you, Bob Woodward, hear anything in your research and your interviews that sounded like espionage or collusion?
I did not. And, of course, I looked for it hard. And so, you know, there we are. We're going to see what Mueller has. And Dowd may be right. He has something that Dowd and the president don't know about, a secret witness or somebody who is changed their testimony, as you know, that often happens and that can break open or turn a case.
But you've seen no collusion.
I have not.
Bob Woodward, who's not exactly an ally of the President of the United States, in his investigations going back over the last year or two, he hasn't found anything. Mueller's team hasn't found anything. The FBI didn't find anything when they were spying on the Trump campaign. And yet that's how it all supposedly got started, these investigations, because of the clear collusion that was there between the Trump campaign and the Russians Last week, Lisa Page, she testified in, it was a private hearing at Congress. And, of course, she's the one that's now known as the one that went back and forth with Peter Strzok, her colleague there at the FBI. And this latest by John Solomon, he says regarding her testimony, he refers to a response that she gave last week. It's a reflection of us still not knowing. That's how she responded to one question. She was asked about the text messages that went back and forth between her and Strzok. Right around the time that Robert Mueller was appointed as a special prosecutor, that would have been May of last year. And she said, well, what we were talking about, what we were texting to each other, it was a reflection of us still not knowing. I mean, we had been investigating the Trump-Russian collusion angle, and we didn't know. There was nothing there. Solomon says here, with that statement, Page acknowledged a momentous fact. He says, after 9 months of using some of the most awesome surveillance powers afforded to U.S. intelligence, the FBI still had not made a case connecting Trump or his campaign to Russia's election meddling. They hadn't made the case. And yet somehow, Jim Comey managed to get a special counsel or special investigator assigned to this case. It says, Page opined further, acknowledging it still existed in the scope of possibility that there would be literally nothing to connect Trump and Russia, no matter what Mueller or the FBI did. As far as May of 2017, we still couldn't answer the question, she said at another point in the hearing last week. And then John Solomon writes, it might take a few seconds for the enormity of Page's statements to sink in. After all, she isn't just any FBI lawyer. She was a lead. She was a lead on the Russian case when it started in the summer of 2016. So it's been going on for 2 years. 2 years, this investigation. This hoax, as my father said in that article from May. I mean, what they were doing from the summer of 2016 all the way through to May of last year, I mean, that's what sort of transitioned into the Mueller probe. It says here in Solomon's article, shortly after he was fired, ex-FBI Director James Comey told the Senate there was not yet evidence to justify investigating Trump for colluding with Russia. When I left, we did not have an investigation focused on President Trump, Comey testified. That's what he testified. When he left, I mean, the focus wasn't really on Mr. Trump. It says, and Strzok, the counterintelligence boss and lead of the Russian probe, texted Page in May 2017 that he was reluctant to join Mueller's probe and leave his senior FBI post because he feared there's no big there. So all of these main players, the ones that are leading the attack against President Trump, they've acknowledged somewhere along the way, all of them, that there was nothing there. And yet it continues. John Solomon asked, which raises the question, if there was no concrete evidence of collusion, why did we need a special prosecutor? I mean, if there's no crimes being committed, why the special prosecutor? It says Page's comments also mean FBI and justice officials likely leaked a barrage of media stories just before and after Mueller's appointment that made the evidence of collusion look far stronger than the frontline investigators knew it to be. It goes on and talks about all these leaks and these text messages to reporters at the Washington Post, the Associated Press, the New York Times. And of course, we've seen that more recently, too, with the text messages between Strzok and Page, that they had a leak strategy. They had a leak strategy to get the message out there, the narrative out there that the Trump campaign colluded with Russia. They were leaking that it was happening, even as they were looking at evidence suggesting strongly that it wasn't happening. And so my father said in that May issue of The Trumpet, the entire investigation is based on a hoax. John Solomon says here at the end, no matter where Mueller ends his probe, it's now clear the actions that preceded his appointment turned justice on its head, imposing the presumption of guilt upon a probe whose own originators had reason to doubt the strength of their evidence. Guilty, you see, until proven innocent. In fact, it's not even that. It's worse. It's something worse than that. It's just he's guilty. Even after 2 years of innocence, facts that prove innocence, the investigation goes on. Andy McCarthy, in his latest, he says the FBI and the Obama Justice Department launched an investigation of the Democrats' political adversaries, and they used Clinton campaign-generated foreign-provided innuendo to do it. They strained to make a case on Donald Trump, even as they were burying a daunting criminal case on Mrs. Clinton. And he says further on, as I've previously explained, the president was misled about his status. Not only was he a suspect in the investigation, he was the main suspect. I mean, they said, oh, you're not the suspect here. And then Comey would testify later. He wasn't really the main target, but he is. And that's obvious now. The operating assumption of the Obama administration in the months before the 2016 election was that the Trump campaign was complicit in the Kremlin's hacking conspiracy. Otherwise, the FBI would not have made this representation to the FISA court 4 times, including twice after President Trump was already in office. So they used that, the Trump-Russian collusion narrative, they used that as a pretext to get the FISA warrants. And all of it, like my father said, all of it's based on a hoax. And the relentless attacks, they keep right on coming. Another point that my father made in that Saving America article is he said we're getting a hard look at just what the radical left is willing to do in order to seize power and stay in power. We're getting a good look at it every day, every week, every month. What they will do to grab hold of power, what they will do to maintain power. They don't respect the rule of law. They believe they're above law. They believe the ends justify the means. Any way possible to regain power. My father said in that May article, this evil spiritual power is influencing the radical left. Most Republicans don't realize what they're dealing with. They just don't realize it. And so here come all the reports now of the Kavanaugh hearing and what he evidently did back in high school. All of these charges, first anonymously put forward, and now the woman comes forward. And you have quite a few Republicans already backpedaling. And then look at all of the Obama people that are out and about as they were over the weekend. I'll come back to the Kavanaugh situation here in just a second. Former President Biden, Vice President Biden, he was out giving a speech and was quite angry as he talked about Donald Trump and what he and Biden, that is, he and Barack Obama decided to do a few months into the Trump administration. Here's the former vice president speaking over the weekend, clip two.
You know, Barack and I agreed to remain silent for a while to give this administration a chance to get up and running the first year. God forgive me. But I could not remain silent after Charlottesville. No, I want to be deadly earnest with you about this. That's why I wrote an article for Atlantic Magazine entitled The Battle for America's Soul.
That's Vice President Biden over the weekend. The gloves are now off. He's out and about. You've heard some clips recently from Barack Obama. The gloves are off. Anything goes. It's a high-stakes midterm election coming up. And so you've got all the heavy hitters from the Obama administration that are out in full force accusing Donald Trump of this or that, as he said there. Charlottesville, in his mind, was the tipping point. Here's what he went on to say. Clip three.
We are in a fight for America's soul. And we have leaders. We have leaders who, at the time when that occurred, when these guys were accompanied by white supremacists and Ku Klux Klan and those who objected, making a comparison, saying they're good people in both groups. What has become of us? Our children are listening, and our silence is complicity.
And so we've got to rise up, as so many of them have been saying. Nancy Pelosi, I can't understand why people aren't rising up in the streets. Maxine Waters is calling for that. Here's the former vice president now, saying that the current administration, he supports white supremacists and the Ku Klux Klan. Donald Trump is a Klan supporter, a racist. John Kerry, he was on a talk show Friday night. Here's what he had to say about Donald Trump. Clip four.
He really is the rare combination of a 8-year-old boy. I mean, he's got the maturity of an 8-year-old boy with the insecurity of a teenage girl.
And there you have it, a big laugh. He's on the comedy circuit. He's promoting his book, his story. And they're saying that the president's an 8-year-old boy, or like one, and like an insecure teenager. Here's what he had to say about, not just the last election, but going back to 2004 and then going back to the year 2000. This is John Kerry on Friday night, clip five.
So what do we do when we only have two parties and when only one side plays decently? You lost a very close election.
One state. 65,000 votes in one
right.
state changed.
You could have contested it. Al Gore could have went a lot further with his protest.
Well, Al Gore was elected president of the United States.
Right.
Just wasn't counted.
Right. But what I'm saying is...
That's John Kerry saying Al Gore did win. He actually won in 2000, but he got cheated out of it. And then in 2004, with... Kerry running against George W. Bush, he would have won. He could have contested it too, Bill Maher was saying there. And of course, he's made a pretty big point about being swift-boated, as he said, following that defeat. Hillary, of course, they all believe she won in 2016. She would have won were it not for Russian interference. I mean, you see the pattern. This has been going on for two decades. We're getting a hard look at just what the radical left is willing to do in order to seize power. What they're willing to do to maintain their grip on power, whether it's in the White House or the Supreme Court or Congress. Anything goes. Anything goes, and we're seeing it. Here's what the former Attorney General Eric Holder, here's what he had to say over the weekend, clip six.
They're just too busy figuring out how to make America great again. Now, you know, every time I hear that phrase, I wonder, when exactly do they have in mind? What time period do they want to wind the clock back to? What century? What decade? What year? Certainly, it was not when people were enslaved. Certainly, it was not when segregation was the law of the land. Certainly, it was not when women were disenfranchised. Certainly, it was not when the LGBT community was routinely stigmatized. This sort of thinking, this make America great mindset, is not only flawed, it's rooted in fear. And it favors an imagined past over a realistic future.
So some shots there at President Trump, and then also the usual contempt for history. The contempt for history. It favors an imagined past over a realistic future. He went on to talk about just how much better everything was in our day, in our modern day. Well, at least up until 2016. Now, I mean, we're taking some massive steps backward, but we were making so much progress. We were moving forward. So he's out on the campaign trail. And then, of course, you have all the allegations aimed at Brett Kavanaugh and how that his Supreme Court nomination, it's now plunged into chaos, they're all writing, because of one woman coming forward from 35 years ago accusing him of sexual assault. And this comes right at the end of, well, how many, you've seen stories about how many hours he spent there at the hearings and testimony. How many hours he spent with senators privately, vetted by the FBI 6 times. Look at what they did during the hearing itself. Cory Booker and all of his grandstanding, his I Am Spartacus moment, coming forward with these supposedly secretive emails that had been released by Congress that morning. And yet he comes forward and he says, look, I'm breaking the rules. You can go ahead and penalize me if you want. And he wasn't even breaking the rules, but he was pleading with all of Congress and all of America to go ahead and penalize me. I'll be a martyr. I'm sounding the alarm. I'm telling you the truth about Brett Kavanaugh. Kamala Harris, she chopped a statement that Kavanaugh had made where he was quoting some source. I forget all the details of the story, but she said it was a dog whistle. He was going after women's rights. And she snipped the quote, took just the part that said what she wanted it to say and left it. It was completely out of context. Fox News says, but the fact checkers didn't find Harris's commentary or the edited video even remotely accurate. The Washington Post gave the senator 4 Pinocchios its most egregious rating, saying the Post omitted crucial facts, such as that Kavanaugh was actually quoting the terminology used by the plaintiff in a 2013 court case rather than stating his actual views. She took something he was quoting and then put it on her Twitter feed saying this is what he actually believes. It's a completely made up, in other words. A total fabrication. What are we seeing? We're getting a hard look at just what the radical left is willing to do in order to seize power, in order to stay in power. We're seeing it every day. And then now this. Dianne Feinstein coming up with this anonymous accuser last week, Thursday or Friday, I forget which. But she's anonymous. And then she comes out on Sunday and reveals who she is. Just after she was able to delete all of her social sites so that people can't get in there and see what kind of a left-wing activist she is. The Spectator says today, if you smell the stench of skullduggery emanating from Dianne Feinstein's anonymous, quote-unquote, letter concerning sexual misconduct by SCOTUS nominee Brett Kavanaugh, your nose didn't deceive you. Feinstein has had the letter since July, but waited until after Kavanaugh's confirmation hearings ended before referring it to the FBI. And of course, even the FBI, even this FBI, dismissed it and handed it over to the White House. They're not going to look into something this bogus. The senator claimed its author had requested confidentiality and declined to come forward or press the matter further. But as the Washington Post admitted yesterday, Christine Blasey Ford contacted them at the same time she reached out to Feinstein. Did she conclude, this is the accuser. She contacted Dianne Feinstein's office a few months ago and then the Washington Post as well. So they were all in on it. Here's more collusion. Did Ford make a deal with the Democrats and the Post to hide behind the shield of anonymity until it was too late for the Trump administration to replace Judge Kavanaugh with another nominee who could be confirmed before the midterms? I mean, if she was traumatized like this, and then came forward with the information 4 months ago. And Feinstein knew about it and the Washington Post. Why did they sit on it? Why did they conceal it? Why did they wait until after all the interviews, until after all the hearings, pushing it right up to where we just about get the vote in Congress for his confirmation? And now that whole process could be derailed. Delayed. That's really what they want. They just want it delayed, because if they can push it back closer and closer to midterms, their hope, of course, is that, and this is brought out in that Spectator piece, their hope, of course, is that they'll pick up a seat or two in the Senate and then have control over these kinds of confirmation hearings in the future and ensure that Brett Kavanaugh not only is nuked, but that they can get someone in there that comes from their left-wing political spectrum. It says here, the Washington Post story says in passing that Ford is a registered Democrat. Her social media accounts appear to have been scrubbed by some information, but some information remains suggesting that she is a member in good standing of the resistance. She's part of the resistance against Donald Trump. And it gives examples in this piece. It appears, the Spectator writes, that while she was hiding behind her anonymity, most of her other political activity was deleted from the internet. It just disappeared. This is a well-known tactic from the radical left. Hillary Clinton used this. If there's anything incriminating on those social media sites, you've got to scrub them. You've got to make them disappear. And that's what she did. And this article talks about, well, you look back at the history in the 80s, Robert Bork, and then, of course, Clarence Thomas, even though he made it through, barely, because of Anita Hill. Thomas called that one in 1991 a high-tech lynching. And the Spectator says this time around it was worse, because it was brought on by an anonymous accuser. And she remained anonymous just long enough for all of her social sites to be scrubbed. Referring to Clarence Thomas, the 1991 hearings, the Spectator brings out, at least, even though she was lying, at least Anita Hill came forward publicly. Listen to this, though. It says, his accuser, Anita Hill, was not at all credible, but she did at least have the brass to make her baseless accusations in public. The same cannot be said of Christine Blasey Ford. While she hid behind the anonymity granted by the Democrats and the Washington Post, waiting for the signal to attack, Judge Kavanaugh has been seriously harmed. Like Justice Thomas, he will forever bear the mark of Cain. Thomas was, as recently as Friday, alluded to in a major publication as follows. Listen to this. This is about Judge Clarence Thomas of the Supreme Court. He was confirmed in 1991 following the spectacle with Anita Hill and the major media. Well, a major publication reports just the other day, there's already one credibly accused sexual aggressor on the Supreme Court who's cast vote after vote denying women the right to control their biological destiny. I mean, there's already one on the Supreme Court who's been credibly accused as a sexual aggressor. We don't need another one. We've already got Clarence Thomas. We don't need Brett Kavanaugh. The Spectator says, never mind that this is a reprehensible lie. It has been repeated so often that it permeates the public square like the smell of an open sewer. They lie and then they just continue to lie. We're getting a hard look at what they're willing to do to seize power, at what they're willing to do to maintain their grip on power. Here's this lie, recycled after, what, 26, 27 years? And Judge Thomas, he has to wake up in the morning and read these kinds of scurrilous allegations. 27 years after the fact. It's a reprehensible lie. Spectator says, likewise, as Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Chuck Grassley said, while Ford's accusations were still from an anonymous source, Judge Kavanaugh's background has been thoroughly vetted by the FBI on six different occasions throughout his decades of public service, and no such allegation ever surfaced. Vetted six times. Decades of public service. 65 women from his high school years coming forward to vouch for his character. But one woman, one anonymous source, that was kept private, kept in the background for 4 months, right up until the week that Congress was to vote on this particular nominee. We're getting a hard look, aren't we, of what they're willing to do to gain power. This trend, as my father said in America Under Attack, this trend toward lawlessness, it's deadly. Kathleen Parker, she had a column over the weekend. There are no words except perhaps desperate, scurrilous, and embarrassing to anyone with a conscience and a grown-up brain. This is what they're resorting to. And as she goes on to explain, I mean, I'm certainly not a Donald Trump supporter here. But I am for fairness. We're not getting a lot of that these days. It says here in my father's booklet, we must open our eyes to recognize the evil force that is behind this push to undermine law. Those are some quotes from America Under Attack, and then, of course, Saving America from the Radical Left, that May issue of The Trumpet, that article that we've referred to so many times. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. When we come back, we'll look a little bit more at that Puerto Rico story that came into the news in full force last week. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Freedom is one of the most sought-after ideals in human history. Man's search for freedom has taken him into the fiercest of protests, struggles, revolutions, civil wars, even world wars. Today, in the midst of free societies, many continue to fight for what they perceive as ever greater freedoms. And yet, many of these same people are actively fighting against law. Few people understand that this war against law actually undermines true freedom. To learn more, request Gerald Fleury's booklet, No Freedom Without Law. In this free booklet, you will see what the Bible says about the latter-day spirit of rebellion and lawlessness that is now so common in our nations today. Also request America Under Attack. In this booklet, you will learn more about the spirit behind this attack on law. You'll see where this is leading. Both booklets are offered freely at no cost or obligation to you. Request No Freedom Without Law and America Under Attack. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
Donald Trump has killed those people twice. Once through neglect and oversight, and secondly, disgracing that they died at all. And that's what death denial, that's what Holocaust denial, that's what all these denial syndromes are all about, is killing the person twice.
That's Jennifer Rubin. I guess she's considered to be one of the more conservative commentators at the Washington Post, saying that Donald Trump, she's talking about the victims of the hurricane in Puerto Rico last year, Donald Trump killed them twice. He killed those victims, 3,000. That's what everyone has accepted. 3,000 people, he's guilty of murdering them, not once, but twice. Well, there was a piece in the Orange County Register, just to follow on what we talked about some on Friday's program. You can go back and listen to that at the Trumpet.com website. But on Friday, we went through the tweet that President Trump sent out, I guess, the day before. And then the reaction, the hysterical reaction to the tweet. This is Carl Cannon at the Orange County Register. He says it wasn't just Puerto Rico who reacted angrily. Fiercely critical responses came from Trump-hating TV types, but also from Florida Republicans. The mainstream media simply dismissed his assertions as falsehoods. Liberals used it as evidence of racism. And late-night TV types had a fit. How can he say this? Another conspiracy theory. He's saying that 3,000 people did not die in those two hurricanes that swept through Puerto Rico last September. Here's what one comedian, a late-night comedian, had to say, mocking him. Clip 10.
That's the official death toll, you lunatic. Now we know why he's so orange. His brain is just melted pumpkin guts.
I mean, you heard that kind of reaction in some of those more serious speeches over the weekend. Laughing, ridiculing, mocking. I mean, that's their strategy. This is where they're going. What they're willing to do to regain power. This article at the Orange County Register, though, he says, actually, official death toll is exactly what it is not. Here's this comedian saying, that's the official death toll, you lunatic. And it's actually not at all. Myers, it says, not only acted even more childishly than the president he was belittling, but he was being intellectually lazy as well. Moreover, such comments confirmed a key part of Trump's claim. His critics have definitely exploited Puerto Rico's suffering to hammer the president. See, that's what they hated about that tweet the most. Because there has been debate over the actual figures. There has been for months. But he said, look, they're inflating the numbers. Because they're using it to beat me over the head with it. I mean, you just heard what Jennifer Rubin said. He's killed them twice. He killed them by neglecting them when they needed help, supposedly. And then he killed them with the tweet, saying that it never happened, denying it happened. Well, he goes on, this article from the Orange County Register, and talks about how that since the 1980s, these social scientists have been grappling with how to put an exact figure on something where you don't have an actual body count. It's called excess mortality. I mean, how can you determine what was actually attributed to the storm, either directly or indirectly? This article says, an article in the British Medical Journal estimated some 650,000 excess Iraqi deaths in the 40 months following the U.S. invasion. You might remember this from back in the early 2000s. You'd hear of a few thousand here, and then all of a sudden, it's not a few thousand, it's hundreds of thousands of civilian deaths because of George W. Bush. 40 months, and so here come these social scientists, and they're trying to put an exact figure on how many died as a result of the U.S. invasion. And as it happens, it comes right at a time when he's up for re-election, or I guess it was the midterms in this case. The figure was 7 times higher than the toll based on body counts. 7 times higher. It was based on field surveys. This is the Iraq War deaths. Field surveys supposedly done by a former health official in Saddam Hussein's government, and was authored by outspoken critics of the Iraq War and of George W. Bush. It was also time to come out just before the 2006 midterm elections. How about that? So is it possible, going back to what we discussed on Friday, is it possible for scholars at Harvard and Georgetown University or George Washington University, is it possible for them to skew the numbers a bit if it hurts Donald Trump? Is it possible for researchers, for scholars to be politically motivated? It's all politics these days. It says here, I don't know how much Donald Trump knows about this topic, this so-called excess mortality, but he apparently is aware that excess mortality is not how U.S. authorities have previously tallied storm deaths. The National Hurricane Center, for example, estimated that 1,833 people died in Hurricane Katrina, most from drowning. So President Trump, he understands this. He says, well, hang on a second. You didn't count other hurricanes this way. You didn't arrive at the death toll this way with other hurricanes during Barack Obama's administration or even administrations before his. It says here, in Puerto Rico, there were myriad problems getting accurate data, the biggest being that electricity was knocked out for so long. This inhibited the reporting ability of island health officials. It also led to deprivations that killed health-impaired residents months after the hurricane season ended. In that environment, excess mortality studies made sense. Inevitably, they would be imprecise and perhaps just wrong. The first such study, listen to this. The first such study by researchers at Penn State University estimated the number of deaths at 1,085. When the government in San Juan was still listing the official death toll at 64. 64. It says days later, the New York Times, using island death certificates, produced an estimate of 1,052. What about that, New York Times? Where's the New York Times last week? Now it's 3,000. But based upon death certificates, based upon a study by the New York Times, not that long ago, it was about 1,000. Did any of this history work its way into the Sunday talk shows? Or the reaction to President Trump's tweet? Here are these numbers, these stats, these figures. They're just all over the map. New York Times. Before that, Penn State. More recently, Harvard. Harvard was next, it says here. Its study, trumpeted uncritically around the world, had problems. For one thing, its range of 793 to 8,498 excess deaths was unhelpful. So the media, they settled on the median figure, 4,645, which was little more than a guess. The bigger problem is that the methodology was a mishmash. Harvard's researchers compared actual deaths in 2016 to estimates based on interviews, polling surveys in 2017. I mean, these are the brightest minds, I guess. The brightest minds trying to find the figures, trying to come up with the death count, the body count. It says here, that's the background when the governor of Puerto Rico tapped George Washington University School of Public Health to do another excess mortality survey. It says, like all such studies, it's based on assumptions and guesswork. In this case, assumptions complicated by the outward migration of tens of thousands of Puerto Ricans to the mainland after the hurricane. See, how do you arrive at an exact figure? Take the Iraq War. What about ones who fled the country, who just disappeared, who went into Jordan or to Syria or Turkey? And here again, after those two storms last year, months and months without electricity. How many of them fled to Florida? It's hard to say. It's impossible to say. It says, although the president has no evidence this was a Democratic Party plot, his skepticism is understandable, even healthy. It's how journalists are supposed to think. I mean, aren't the journalists supposed to be skeptical? Wait a minute. How did you arrive at that number? How did you arrive at 3,000? Why was it 64 a month earlier? Aren't the journalists the ones who are supposed to be skeptical? As it is, it's the president of the United States, and he gets pounced on. He's a liar. He's a conspiracy theorist. Brock Long, he was on one of the Sunday shows yesterday with Chuck Todd. And just giving some, well, at least he's intellectually honest. Because Chuck Todd, he can't wait to get to the tweet about Puerto Rico and the death count. Here he is interviewing Chuck Long, or rather Brock Long, the FEMA director. This is Chuck Todd asking him about that that death count from last year. Here's clip 7.
The president has been disputing the death toll, multiple tweets. He said over many months, it went to 64 people, then like magic, 3,000 people killed. Believe it or not, Mr. Long, the White House put out a 5-page backgrounder citing other death toll numbers that were less than the one that the governor of Puerto Rico has accepted. 2,975 people died as a result of Hurricane Maria or impact from Hurricane Maria, according to the Puerto Rican government. Does FEMA accept that number?
So the numbers are all over the place. FEMA doesn't count deaths. And if you take what's going on with Florence, the deaths that are verified by the local county coroners are the ones that we take.
The ones verified by the local county coroners. That's where you get the 64. And FEMA, does FEMA accept the number? Look, the numbers are all over the place. Is that true or is that not true? That is true. That is a true statement by the FEMA director. The numbers are all over the map. And isn't it interesting that right as we're about to get hit by another hurricane, here come these figures, 2,975. And who does Donald Trump think that he is to question that? This one, this next one here is a little bit longer, but just listen to the exchange and listen again. Listen to, on the case of, or in the case of Brock Long, the FEMA director, he's just being intellectually honest. As he's there, I guess, to talk about the hurricane sweeping through the Carolinas. But Chuck Todd can't understand why President Trump would be preoccupied with Puerto Rico. It's the press. It's the mainstream media who are preoccupied with this. They're obsessed with this because they're obsessed with all things Trump. That's the way it's been for the last year and a half. Carrying on in this exchange, this is clip 8.
Why is the White House so concerned about the difference between 3,000 deaths and, say, another report that might have had it at 1,800 deaths? I mean, you've said yourself it doesn't matter, but the White House believes it matters. Why?
Well, I'll tell you this. You know, one thing about President Trump is that he is probably the one president that has had more support for what goes on back here. And I think he's defensive because he knows how hard these guys behind me work day in and day out for a very complex situation. And it's frustrating. Those studies, the Harvard study was done differently than the George Washington study or this study or that study. And the numbers are all over the place. And where the 65...
Hold on. Is it fair? I mean, he said Democrats did it to make them look bad. Do you believe any of these studies were done to make the president look bad?
Well, I mean, I don't think the studies... I don't know why the studies were done. I mean, I think what we're trying to do, in my opinion, what we've got to do is figure out why people die from direct deaths, which is the wind, the water, and the waves, buildings collapsing, which is probably where the 65 number came from. And then there's indirect deaths. So the George Washington study looked at what happened 6 months after the fact. And, you know, what happens is, and even in this event, you might see more deaths indirectly occur as time goes on because people have heart attacks due to stress. They fall off their house trying to fix their roof. They die in car crashes because they went through an intersection where the stoplights weren't working. You know, the other thing that goes on, there's all kinds of studies on this that we take a look at. Spousal abuse goes through the roof. You can't blame spousal abuse, you know, after a disaster on anybody. And the president's very passionate about the work we've done. He's been incredibly supportive of me and the staff. He's actually, I bet he's probably the only president that's held 2 cabinet level meetings, brought his entire cabinet to this agency to show support. They come through this agency every day. And he's He's very supportive, which is exactly what FEMA needs.
There's the FEMA director basically saying, you know, the president's doing a really good job. He's worked really hard. He's brought two cabinet-level meetings down here to be with us, to make sure that we're ready, to make sure that we're prepared, to make sure that we can respond and respond quickly. And he could say it until he's blue in the face or orange in the face, to take everyone that mocks him, to take what they say. And they still wouldn't believe him. They won't believe that he did anything good in Puerto Rico. He's the cause. I mean, he's committed murder. He's murdered them twice. This is regular news talk shows. I mean, those aren't crazy statements. Those aren't conspiracy theories. For John Kerry to say that Al Gore won, that's not a conspiracy theory. That's just facts. The way that the radical left sees it, those are facts. Truth fails. Truth fails. They come up with the line. Everybody in the audience laughs and ridicules. And what suffers most of all is truth. Truth, that's in Isaiah 59. Hosea 4 says, my people are destroyed for a lack of knowledge. I mean, above all, Americans need the truth. They need to know what's happening to their country. They need to know what's happening behind the scenes. They need a hard look at what the radical left is willing to do to seize control of power, to maintain power, to bork someone out of the Supreme Court, even with some kind of a scurrilous allegation that comes forward anonymously at first. Right a minute before the clock strikes midnight. Right before he's about to be confirmed. I mean, you've got to pull out all the stops. We thought about being dignified for a few months, but then this happened, and so the gloves have come off. And of course, the reason that they hate Donald Trump so much is because he fights back. And so it's a slugfest, and it's back and forth. And everyone, in the end, everyone suffers, because as I say, the truth fails. When we come back, we'll conclude today's program with just a brief update on the hurricane that swept through the Carolinas. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily. Don't forget to visit our website at thetrumpet.com. Every day, thetrumpet.com will help you understand your world by analyzing today's headlines under the clear light of Bible prophecy. Log on to thetrumpet.com and sign up for our daily Trumpet Brief email and subscribe to The Trumpet Magazine. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is The Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
At last check, the death toll for Hurricane Florence was 16, I believe it was, following the record levels of rainfall throughout North Carolina, South Carolina. I think something like 800,000 people in both of those states were without power yesterday. The little town of Wilmington, a coastal city, has pretty much been cut off by the flooding. All the roads into and out of the community are flooded over. And so I think its population, I'm not sure if this would include those that fled in advance of the storm, but the population of the city is 120,000 people. So quite a few people are at the moment stranded. And this is, of course, the city too, where there's been reports of looting as well, just being pounded by rain. And then you have, as I said at the top of the show, you have this Typhoon Mangkhut that's working its way through southern China, and that's already killed 64 people in the Philippines, and I think a few more are added to the death toll there with this powerful typhoon or this powerful storm in China as well. On tomorrow's program, I wanted to just talk some. I ran out of time today, but I wanted to talk some about, while this is going on, you have all of the drought and the fires out west in the United States. And I mean, this aligns perfectly with a prophecy that you can read about in Amos chapter 4. You can read about it in my father's article from earlier this year, The Deadly Climate Change Delusion, that was based on a Key of David program that he gave at the end of last year. And of course, we have a booklet as well, a powerful little booklet, one that actually keeps getting bigger with each new update, and that is Why Natural Disasters. But that's all that we have time for on today's program. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We thank you for joining us on today's program, and we'll see you again tomorrow.